Windy and bitterly cold, a high of only 3 above, wind chills down to 30 below. Right now, wind west from the west at 10, minus 8 Racine, minus 7 Kenosha, minus 13 in Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. The wind chill hovering around 23 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is up next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I recently heard from Anna Static, who is on the staff of the library at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And she alerted me to a course that is about to be taught that concerns the Iliad, one of the great towering masterworks of Western civilization. And Anna Static suggested, and I'm so glad she did, that I speak with the faculty member at Parkside who is going to be teaching this course. And her name is Dana Oswald, and she happens to be department chair and professor of English Literature and Languages at Parkside, as well as, I believe, director of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Parkside, and also the author of several different books. And she is going to be teaching this course, which is titled pretty simply and directly, Reading the Iliad. And this is a free community class with meetings in February and March, I think 4 sessions in all, 2 weeks apart, in which people will be reading and then discussing and exploring the Iliad. And that is a brand new translation of the Iliad. And so we're going to be taking a few minutes today on the morning show to talk about the Iliad and Homer, to whom it is attributed, and about some of the important themes that are part of this important work. And we'll also probably take a few minutes at the outset to find out a little more about the work that Dana Oswald does, particularly in her specialty, which is the Middle Ages. And that is the focus of a couple of different books she has already written and is working on in terms of a third. So we have a lot of ground to cover. And Dana Oswald, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. That was such a nice introduction.
I'm really happy to make your acquaintance and glad we can have this conversation. Anna Static has given me several great ideas before, and this is, I can tell already, is yet another one. Ahead of us talking specifically about Homer and the Iliad and so on, I think it would be interesting, first of all, to untie this intriguing title that you are a professor of English Literature and Languages. Explain the way in which this academic field is sort of shaped at Parkside.
Well, at Parkside, we have combined our language programs with our literature programs. And so I am both the chair of English and Spanish, although Spanish is not my area of specialty.
Ah, okay.
So we just sort of govern the languages in general, and we do our best to take care of the languages, both English and Spanish.
Right. So I can tell from the books that you have written, which most recently, I think, Conceiving Bodies, Reproduction in Early Medieval English Medicine, which sounds so fascinating. And I understand this book is available to me at Carthage, where I teach. And
yes.
So I've not had a chance yet to seek it out, but I really want to. So explain, first of all, your interest in history and its intersection with your work with literature and so on.
Well, I always come to history through the literary text. I think seeing the words that people wrote in the past tells us something about their interiority, about the ways that they saw the world. And I think that's how we have to see those sort of historical markers, right through the lens of the voices of the people themselves, when we can. Right. And the Middle Ages, you know, I know is a long time ago, but we have so many texts from that moment. And I think often for me, the reason I came to medicine is because people have viewed it as technical, as somehow not representing a kind of interiority of people. But I think it talks to the kinds of things that people wanted or needed, right? So we have insane remedies. They're wild, right? So we have people wolfing or milking wolves, right? So we need wolf's milk to solve somebody's infertility problem. Actually, that one is for a miscarriage. But we have all these wild ingredients, and I think a lot of people will laugh about the ingredients, and they are laughable, but they also betray the kind of desire for health that people have. How desperate are you to find a remedy for a problem? How much do you need this? What kinds of problems do you have? How do you understand those problems and bodies, right? Mm. So in what ways can a body go wrong, right? And what do we do to help with that?
And of course, we're talking about a period in history when we really don't have science as we think of it now. I mean,
that's
in modern terms. I mean, it is people trying to come to understanding of some of these questions without a lot of the basic tools that nowadays we kind of take for granted in terms of inquiry, for instance.
Right. I think that there are philosophical systems in place that informed the kinds of medicine that people practice, right? So you have the idea of the humors. And so that was understood to be science of its day.
Right.
Just as our science now is understood to be science of its day, and maybe 200 years from now, we will look like we're milking wolves also, right? I think that there's that long historical view that we need to take into account. Whenever we laugh at the past, remember that we also will be the past.
Sure, absolutely. Sooner than we realize. Exactly. You touched on something interesting, which is that there are a lot of texts from medieval times that are fascinating and worth exploring. And, of course, I think a lot of us assume that not to be the case because, of course, when we're talking about at least most of the medieval era, that's before Gutenberg, before mass production of the printed word. And so So we think of the printed word as of being quite a rare thing, which doesn't mean it didn't exist, obviously. And from just the way you kind of couched that particular statement, it sounds like maybe there is more from the Middle Ages in terms of the printed word than a lot of us assume there to be.
I think there is a lot more. I mean, and it, of course, it's not printed. Right now it's printed, but at the time, no, it's handwritten. And so that does put some limits on how much you can produce. The production of a text is incredibly labor-intensive and expensive when you don't have those means, right? But that being said, I think we tend to privilege only texts like Beowulf, which I love, and we'll talk about at length at any time, given any opportunity. But I think that there are so many more texts that are available to us. We're fortunate that we're in a moment where different translations and different editions are being published, and there's an interest in moving beyond these sort of canonical texts and thinking about the ways we can see the world more fully by having access to things that, I mean, people might have perceived as boring. But if you read these remedies, they are anything but boring.
Mm. So when one is interested in studying this period, what are some of the challenges that are involved when we are, I'm talking about the medieval period. We're about to go even further back in history when we start talking about the Iliad. But what are some of the challenges as well as some of the special satisfactions of studying this period versus other periods of history that are not quite so distant?
I think the real difficulty is the language, right? And so if you're somebody who doesn't know Old English, which is, I would say, most of the world, right, you're going to come to these texts through translation. That will be true of Greek, too. Most people don't read Greek. Most people aren't going to return to the ancient Greek, right, to read Homer. And of course, whenever we have a translation, something is lost, right? We lose the original language, we lose the cadence, we lose the special words, we apply the filter of contemporary language to a past that maybe didn't understand the world in the same way. Mm. So we lose those things. But that doesn't mean that we have zero access to some of those principles of language. So, you know, when we come to Wilson, we'll talk about this, I assume. She herself is an expert in Greek, and so her introduction does a lot of work to sort of say, here are the ideas, here is some of the language, here is what the poetry might have felt like, right? And that's true for Old English, too. You might not need to know the whole of the language, But there are a few words that you can come to, and you can think about what those words mean and how they work and what kind of resonances those words might have had. So there's little pinholes in, right, even if you're not, if you don't have that primary access to the language itself. And for that, you can read my book.
There you go. Absolutely. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Dana Oswald, who is Department Chair and Professor of English Literature and Languages at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And she is going to be teaching a free community class during February and March. And it focuses on the Iliad, and specifically a new translation that we'll be talking about as well by one Emily Wilson. And you were mentioning before we went on the air that this particular class, which is titled simply, directly, Reading the Iliad, is part of what you and others hope will be an ever-widening project of opportunities that I think you're calling intellectual curiosity or something like that.
Yes.
Tell us more about, you know, just some of those aspirations.
Well, I think one thing that we really hope to do is make the university accessible to the community. I think the Wisconsin idea is invested in bringing the university to every corner of the state, and this is the kind of program we hope will do that too. We want people who maybe don't already have a relationship with the university, or who are missing their time at the university, or who studied in different fields who've never had a chance to talk about literature in that setting. We want to invite all kinds of people in, and we want to have that kind of conversation with people from different parts of our community, different parts of the intellectual world, right? I think there are so many ways to be a smart person, and I think there's so many smart people, and that's what we really want this entire program to be about. For us, we're starting with the Iliad because I love it, and I want to read it, and I wanted to have an excuse to read it with other people, because I think books are better when we talk about them. But I think the program, the idea of intellectual curiosities, is to invite other scholars in with their areas of expertise and to ask people to really do some work, right? Not just to sit and listen to a lecture, which is wonderful, and I think that's important too, but to engage with the primary text, to read things and to work through things and to struggle. Right? Because I think that's where the real learning takes place, is in the struggle, in the conversation, in the discourse, right? In the meaning making, and not just in the receiving of somebody else's interpretation.
So it was your idea then to create a course for the community about the Iliad?
Yes. I teach the Odyssey every fall. Every other fall, I get to teach the Odyssey. And I keep wanting to shoehorn the Iliad into that class, but there's just not enough time, right? These are two really, really long texts, and our teachers in the high schools, they need to have exposure to the Odyssey because that's a text that they're often asked to teach. So I can't pull that out and shove the Iliad in. So here we are. I wanted to read it with some people, so I tried to make a place where I could do that.
That's great. What a fantastic idea. Maybe this would be as good a time as any. And I'm going to assume, because, of course, the public radio audience is, by and large, a very intelligent group of people and very well-read. So I'm just guessing that most of the people listening have some acquaintance. We're not talking about a completely blank slate. But that being said, I mean, even for those of us who have heard of the Odyssey and heard of the Iliad, for instance, don't necessarily understand the relationship between those two towering works. So let's just start there and at a very basic level with roughly when both the Iliad and the Odyssey were written and shared with the world, and what they maybe share in common, and then what makes them two distinct works of literature.
Well, I think, gosh, now I'm going to show my ignorance. I think we're either in the 6th century or the 8th century BCE. I cannot remember for the life of me which one it is. A really long time ago. And Homer, you know, is the name that we give to the author of these texts, but that's a kind of best guess, right? That we see, this is coming from an oral tradition. It's written down later, I think around the 5th century BCE.
And so attributed to Homer, but...
Attributed to Homer, but who Homer was, right. If he was one guy, right? If this is a collection of, like, the greatest hits of this story that were told over millennia, we don't know those things. And that's part of what I love about the Middle Ages, and what I love about this too is that we can't be like, oh, he ate fish on Tuesday, and therefore there's fish in chapter three, right? We can't sort of over-apply this sort of historicist lens, although, of course, we have to take history into account when we think about this text.
Right.
And these texts. But back to your question, too, about the relationship between the Iliad and the Odyssey. The Iliad occurs earlier in time. Now, the Iliad itself and the Odyssey both are told many years after the events of the story that itself, right? So it, while the Iliad and the Odyssey are old texts, the story they're telling is even older, right? So there's distance between the poet, the speaker, and the story that he's telling. He's telling of a long distant past. And everybody he would have been telling the story to would have known it. So there's no spoilers here, right? Everybody knew how the story was going to end. It was going to end, Achilles is going to die, right? Sorry, spoiler alert to everybody. The Iliad is a story of the anger of Achilles. And the Odyssey is a story of Odysseus, the man, often they say, the man of many ways, right? And his journey home after the Trojan War. But the Iliad is situated in the midst of the Trojan War, in a fight between the Greeks and the Trojans, where the Trojans are, Paris, one of the Trojans, has taken Helen of Troy, given to him by Aphrodite. It's kind of not his fault. her husband, Menelaus, is coming to try to take her back. And so it's about the fight between the Greeks and the Trojans, but really it's about a fight that's taking in the place of the midst of the Greeks themselves between Agamemnon and Achilles over two slave girls, enslaved women, I should say. We're working on our language around this. It's been such a long received story. But yeah, it's a fight over women and many different women, few of whom had any say over their own bodies, their choices, their lives.
Right. I think one of the indications of just how important this work of literature is for a lot of us is the fact that this feels like history, like part of world history, and that many of these things actually happened, literally happened. I don't know of too many works of literature where that is true to this extent. I mean, that it has such a presence in kind of our collective memory that you know, we start to take for granted, I mean, these mythological elements in it, like, well, wait a minute. Oh, wait, this can't be nonfiction. This has to be fiction because you know, there's all these, you know, mythological elements and Greek gods and so on. But it feels like something that actually happened in history. Are there roots in actual history that are to any significant extent part of the story of the Iliad and or the Odyssey?
There seems to have been a place called Troy, and that place called Troy doesn't exist anymore. So it was destroyed. There seems to have been a war between the Trojans and the Greeks. Was it over Helen of Troy? Was she abducted by Aphrodite for Paris? I don't know. I mean, I don't think so. But, you know, I leave space for these things to happen.
Sure. But there's, I guess, one way to answer that is there is absolutely no way to know.
There's no way to know.
Even if there was that glimmer of factual truth, that is lost to history.
Right. I think, though, you know, you're talking to a literature professor. So I will say, you know, my favorite quote to say to my students is that we lie to tell the truth. Right. And I think that any literary text does this, any fictional text is trying to tell a truth. What is the truth? I don't know. You know, what was it really a battle about women, or was it a battle about resources, which it usually is, and women are the excuse for that. I think that there are historical touchstones, right, that gave us the story, because it's a known story, right, in its historical milieu. People knew that there was this fight. They knew that there were these sort of figureheads, right? And so then you have a poet like Homer or any of the other oral storytellers who fleshed it out in order to tell a story that spoke to the people that were hearing it, right? Anytime we tell a story from the past, it's never just about the past. It's also about us. Right. And so I think that's true here, too.
Right. Tell us what you can about, I mean, you've already mentioned that it's somewhere around maybe the 6th century or so that this seems to have emerged, so well after the fact. I mean, to whatever extent we're talking about facts, a factual history, but has this always been important, an important work? I mean, was it, I guess the first question is, was it immediately important as far as we know? I mean, was it immediately something widely embraced and read and discussed and so on? Or did it have more of a slow build in terms of significance? And also, has it been a fairly consistent important work through history, or has its significance kind of ebbed and flowed over time?
I think I can drop in on some moments here and there to fill this in, but I am not a classicist, you know, so I don't know if immediately it was embraced, right? After it's finally written down, if it's circulating. I think in its oral history, yes. I think obviously we don't have something that's 15,000 lines long that somebody memorized and told orally if it's not a story that people want to hear.
Right. Yep.
So I think in that sense, we can certainly say it was popular and it was important enough to tell and to retell, right? It was important enough to write down. And then it was important enough to transcribe when we don't have a printing press, right? People took time to write this story by hand down over millennia, enough to get us to the 15th century, right?
Wow.
But
that says a lot right there, doesn't
right,
it?
Right, right. Just the difficulty of that kind of transmission in any sense. Any text that makes its way to the printing press is a text that has had to overcome obstacles. Now, you know, as with Beowulf, I always like to say, was it something that somebody spilled their coffee on and it just happened to, you know, is it the comic book of its generation, or is it the Iliad, right? We don't know these things, but I think the fact that it made its way there gives us enough of a sense of its importance, of its significance. I think through most of Western civilization, it has kind of had a place. It came late to England, as most things did, but once it got there, there it was. We had neoclassicism then, right? And so then that has informed a lot of the values of Western sort of British colonial culture since then.
Yeah. We're speaking with Dana Oswald, a professor of English literature and languages at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and the teacher of a community course that will be beginning in early February, running into March, 4 sessions. The course titled simply Reading the Iliad. Not that reading the Iliad in and of itself is a simple matter. We're about to talk about the scope of this work and its length, but this course is focusing on a new translation of the Iliad by Emily Wilson. Before we get to the matter of the translation, let's find out a little bit more about this epic poem, and it certainly lives up to that distinction in its length, for one, in one respect, and also kind of the complexity of the way in which it is crafted, particularly for the sake of someone who has never actually directly encountered the Iliad. What are we talking about in terms of its length and complexity?
Well, it's long. It's really, really, really long. I think that is something that often makes people afraid to pick it up, right? You look at this is a large book. It is large. It's got to be 3 inches across, right? So it's big. But I think one way that it is accessible to us is it's broken into 24 books. That's about 670 lines per book. And they vary in length. 670 lines is a lot more accessible, right, than 15,000.
Yeah.
And so there are ways in which the structure of the text itself brings us in. Each of those books kind of has a job, generally one or two jobs that it's doing. And so while the entire sprawling epic does a lot of different jobs, it helps us to understand what's happening here. So we have a battle book, or we have a catalog, a book where we get the list of every major leader and which country they came from and how many ships they came in. Some people would say that was a boring book. It kind of is a boring book, but I will say I just reread it and I wrote down how many ships everybody had, because I was like, how many is this? It's a lot of ships, side note. But it was more interesting to me. So this is, I think, a text that rewards us by returning to it. So if this is a text you've read, please come. But if it's a text you've not read, it's also really interesting the first time through to think about the different ways we've told stories.
Hmm.
So, for instance, one of the most important elements of this epic is its epic simile structure, that it uses epic similes in order to help us understand things, right? So one of my favorites is the epic simile describing Paris. And Paris and Hector are brothers. They're both children of Troy, the king of Troy, of Priam. And Hector is awesome, and Paris is kind of terrible. He's vain, and he's beautiful, and he's not a good warrior, but he's beloved by Aphrodite. And so Hector is always kind of described as a war horse in his epic similes. But Paris is described kind of as a corn-fed pony who likes to run from the river back to his stall so everybody can admire his beauty and his hair is flowing. Mm. And it's just this wonderful little epic simile that tells us so much about what's at stake in this text just through maybe 10, 12 lines of a simile comparing Paris to a pony.
Hmm.
So I think there's great pleasure in a text that isn't in an urgent rush to tell its narrative. I love narrative, right? But I think it's about the how we get to the end and not just getting to the end.
Right.
So once you kind of settle into that, it's a lot more accessible for a reader.
Yeah, and that ends up making it an interesting ride.
Yes.
And so you've already begun to answer my next question, which was these 24 books that collectively comprise the Iliad, that's not a chronological narrative where chapter one, this happens, chapter two, the next thing happens, and so on. It sounds like it's a bit more of a mix than that, since some of the chapters are not devoted to chronicling events, I don't think.
No, I think that's a fair assessment. I would say it's not like a text where we sort of move back and forth in time. I don't think it really does that. I'm thinking really hard now. Does it do that? I don't think so. But we'll have books that are sort of doing a different job than telling a straightforward narrative, right? So and we also move back and forth between the human sphere and the gods. So we'll have a scene. I was just rereading book 4, I think, and we're up in the heavens, and Zeus and Hera are having a conversation. Hera is on the side of the Greeks, and Zeus really loves Troy, but he's gonna let her destroy Troy. So he is just, you know, being very magnanimous in this chapter. So there's the battle that's sort of the gentle battle, I would say, that's taking place in the heavens, and then the sort of like human tragic battle that's taking place on Earth. And so there's some moving back and forth between those spheres.
Hmm. That's fun in and of itself, isn't it?
Oh, it's super fun.
And I suppose then that underscores the fact that part of what we often glean from these stories is how the gods may have very different abilities than we do, but they're an awful lot like us.
Ugh,
in terms
worse
of...
than us, probably. I mean, Zeus specifically, he's awful.
Hmm. Not a fan of Zeus.
Well, he just, you know, has a sense of entitlement, which is perhaps fair when you're the king of the gods, I suppose. But yeah, not so great to human women.
Right. So as I recall, the Iliad is written in its original, of course, Greek, is written in some kind of fancy sort of meter.
Dactylic hexameter.
Right.
Yeah.
So first of all, maybe just tell us a little bit about what that term sort of means. And then when it comes to, for instance, a translation of the Iliad, does that sense of meter still exist? I mean, when a text like this is translated, is a good translator trying to preserve at least some sense of whatever that original meter was?
That's a great question. And I think... it's really complicated, especially when you have a language like Greek, which is so different from English in terms of its cadence, right? Mm. So dactylic hexameter refers to how many syllables are in each line and then the pattern of stresses that are in that line, right? So to say that it's in dactylic hexameter means it has a set number of stresses, a set number of syllables per line for the entirety of 15,000 lines, and then retains that stress structure. Now, there's variation. There has to be variation within that. But certain languages lend themselves more to this given their syntactical structures and their grammatical structures, right? For instance, I mean, I'm going to make a kind of comparison here. In Old English, we don't have a lot of rhyming poetry. Old English doesn't rhyme. It uses stress syllables to do these things. And part of that has to do with the ways of grammatical endings on English words in Old English. They don't lend themselves to rhyming, right? But once we sort of bring French into the language and we end up with Middle English, which has a lot softer end of a word, and these endings are sort of generalized, it's a lot easier to rhyme them, right?
Okay.
So I think the poetic structures of each time are dictated by the state of the language that exists in that culture, right? So when we try to bring dactylic hexameter to present-day English, we're not going to have a lot of luck. It's the amount of forcing of a line to make it fit that meter makes it, frankly, pretty horrible to read.
Right.
I don't think I could say that nobody could do it, but I would say I don't think that Emily Wilson is really trying to do it. Now, does that mean that there aren't moments where she maybe might not play with a line if she could get it to work that way? Maybe she does. I don't know. But I think for me, and I think many people feel differently, a good translation is not necessarily just about preserving what the poetry looked like in its moment, but bringing it to people in a way that they can understand.
Right. So when you look at, for instance, Emily Wilson's translation, and maybe I'm curious about other translations in general, does it look like poetry? Does it read like poetry? Or does it read and look more like prose?
It looks like poetry because of the way the line breaks exist. But I think when we read it out loud, we are not reading it to have that sort of line break feeling. It's not like going to a poetry slam where you feel like you're hearing poetry. But I think it's the play with language, right? It's the simile. It's the figurative language. It's the sort of, I don't know, the ways in which we give description to things that we wouldn't in a normal prose conversation, right? Nobody's going to be like, Paris, as he ran down to the brook like a pony, blah, 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 right? That's where it feels poetic,
okay.
Not necessarily in its meter, I think.
Gotcha, gotcha. So what do you envision in terms of the way in which this exploration of the Iliad is going to occur in this course? And I know that from what you were saying before we even started the interview, that you are hoping that people sooner rather than later will begin actually the task of reading it.
Yeah.
Maybe even ahead of that very first course, whenever
Definitely.
That is.
Definitely. You're assigned the first book of the Iliad before February 6th, if you would like to take this course.
Right. So explain kind of how you envision this journey, if you will.
Well, part of the reason I want people to at least read book one before our first session is that I want them to come in with their struggles. If you haven't read it before, right, and then I go home and say, go home and read 8 books, and you have no idea what you're getting into, you start to read 8 books, you can't get through book one, you don't have any strategies, and you don't know what questions to ask, then you don't show up again, right? And that's
the thing I don't
want to have happen.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping people will struggle through book one, or maybe not. Maybe they'll come in and be like, this is amazing, I just took the time and it works for me. But if you struggle, that's okay. I think struggle is where we learn, right? So I think I want people to have tried for book one, and then we'll come in and we'll have a conversation about what was hard about it. What can you do? How can you note take? How can you annotate? How can you stop when you don't know what's happening and backtrack, right? The kinds of strategies we use as readers of complex texts. I want to have an opportunity to have done that with people who are coming to the class, with them having tried it, right, first. And then, of course, the next sessions, the readings will be much longer, but I wanted people to have that first entry in with a little bit more support.
Right. So when you are actually then in class with these students, what do you envision the conversations or discussions to primarily entail?
This is always the question, right? You can't anticipate what people will care about.
Right.
And so which is one of the joys of teaching, right? If I knew what people were going to care about every time, it would get very boring. But it's never boring, right? Because people see different things. They bring their own experiences. They struggle with stuff that you can't anticipate that they would. They totally get things that you think are hard. There's no way to know what they'll come to you with, which is the great joy of it. And so, you know, as I'm reading, I make lots of notes. And I think about what are the big picture ideas I want people to have understood? So what's happening at a literal level in these books? And what are really important moments that I want to make sure that they haven't missed so that they don't miss something later, right? So I come in with the openness to hearing what people have questions or interests in, but also with an idea of like, here are some things I need you to have understood or seen. Here are some of my favorite moments that I will absolutely be talking about Paris as a Pony. I can't help it. It's my favorite. But I think most of a class that's a good class will be dictated by what the readers care about and what they want to talk about.
One of the things that is intriguing to me is that it's conceivable that some of these students will have seen the relatively recent film, Troy, starring Brad Pitt. That's a film I saw in the theater. And it's a great film
in
terms of the way it is put together. It's well written, it's well acted, well directed. And it is decently true to the original. I mean, I'm certainly no expert on the Iliad, although I did read it in college. But, I certainly recognized the Iliad in what I was seeing in that film. I wonder if you have any thoughts about, in a sense, the baggage that people might bring with them in terms of ways in which this has been fictionalized over the years, or, you know, in some ways altered from what it really is. And of course, your course is focused on the Iliad itself and not treatments of it or variations on it.
Right. I actually really love that. I love when people come to a class and say, well, I saw this, and that's not what this book is doing. Then we have such a great conversation, right? Because it doesn't have to be like that movie ruined this book. Because that movie is doing a different job, and it's giving us something to talk about. So if they're like, this is not at all how I saw Hector. Actually, it is very much how I see Hector. I think that's a pretty great representation of him. But I think that there are always things that movies can't do, right? They can't give us these literary moments that are so lovely and pleasurable. It's like doing a puzzle, right? So it's one thing to look at the end puzzle and be like, well, how clever that is. But it's a whole different thing to put it together, right? And I think that that's in one way, that's what reading this text does for us. So if people come in and they say, well, I know what this text is all about, I love to say, well, let's see if you still think that after you read it, right? Did it do the same thing? If it did, where did it do it? If it didn't, where did it differ? And why do you think the movie made that choice, right? What's the impact of having made that choice, of having left this piece out, or having reconfigured this character, or whatever, right? That's rich. That's wonderful.
Yeah, fascinating. Let's return to the matter of Emily Wilson's translation. And we've already, I think, touched on the fact that she, for good reason, is not trying to somehow recreate pentameter, dactylic hexameter in English. I mean, there would be no reason to do that, and it would certainly probably do a lot more harm than help the cause. Are there other aspects of her translation that you think are noteworthy and which draw you to want to use it versus the myriad of other English translations that already exist?
I think always the issue of translation is one that's situated in its own historical moment. And so there are other wonderful translations of this text, right? There's the Fitzgerald that people often use. There are a lot of different translations. But they themselves are situated in their own historical moment with people's preferences about what a text should look like, the kinds of language it should have. And I honestly think there's been a great deal of gatekeeping around this text, right? Often there is a desire to elevate it. This is an elevated text, but I think often translators make choices that are very, right, elevated. And I think that puts people off in our current moment. And I don't think this is a text that was trying to do that originally. Now, I don't want to make any guesses about the intention of the author. I don't try to do that. But I think it's a text that people were interested in and wanted to hear, right? And so I think what I like about Emily Wilson is I think she wants things to be readable. She wants readers now to read this text and understand it. And so I think it is very much for a contemporary audience. I think it's also reading things with nuance. I think one of the reasons I started teaching her when I was teaching the Odyssey is because she's very sensitive about representations of women. And so Helen is featured in both these texts, and a lot of people love the Helen, you know, whore that I am, is a line that has been translated by most male translators. And Wilson takes this line differently, right? And so she's thinking about not just what the moment in which the translation is occurring and how it sees women. She really thinks about how, what is the word in ancient Greek and what were the resonances of that word? And is it really fair to use some of these very memorable, well-received, well-remembered lines in the way that they have been? So she, I think she really interrogates the language thoughtfully to get away with some of the, or away from some of the biases of language that have become embedded in the text over many, many, many generations of translating it, right?
So we're kind of talking about an agenda that was maybe sometimes present in previous translations.
Sure.
And I suppose, I mean, I guess the term agenda has tends to have negative connotations.
It does.
But that being said, I don't mean it in that negative way. Right. But in a sense, Emily Wilson has an agenda as well. I mean,
absolutely.
There are certain things that are important to her, and the way in which she has translated this text are a reflection of what she perhaps believes to be most important.
I think that's right. And that's true, as I said, for any translator. It's just that I think often people have read a text so many times in so many ways that they don't even realize that they're falling into these traditional ways of thinking. And so I think you need a translator who's like, wait a second, are we so sure about that?
Right.
And then ask the question. And you know, of course, for me, I mean, I am a professor who cares about women's and gender studies, and so it is an angle that's interesting to me. But I don't think Wilson does this only with questions of gender. I think she does this cautiously through the whole text, thinking about why. So, for instance, she was really thoughtful about the wine dark sea, right? This is a phrase that's used to describe the sea consistently through this text. And she really thought about, why are we using that? What would wine have looked like? And why is it wine dark? And what does that word mean? So she's just delightful in this way that she is an etymologist, a philologist. She loves words, and she's careful and thoughtful about the words that she chooses, both in terms of what they would have meant historically and how a contemporary audience can receive those in a way that is meaningful to them.
Yeah. Did you examine a number of translations before choosing Emily Wilson's, or fairly quickly and fairly easily did you settle on this choice? Did this just immediately and easily make sense to you that this was the translation that should be used?
Well, I have been teaching these texts for 30 years.
Whoa.
And so I have used many, many different translations over the years. So when Wilson's Odyssey translation came out a few years ago, I was absolutely stricken by it, right, in the best possible way. Like, this is brilliant. This is something I can see students wanting to read and looking forward to reading. The language is vibrant. It is accessible. It is not trying to exclude people. So I fell in love with that and have never gone back. Now, I have taught the class in such ways that I asked students to compare other translations to Wilson's and to think about why she's making her choices and how they might understand those comparisons. And I will probably bring some moments of translation to our sessions in March and February. But I knew, you know, honestly, the Wilson translation is the reason I wanted to do this. Because it's really hard to, like, look at this volume of 15,000 lines and think, this is my February book that I'm going to read by myself just for me. Right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. You don't read this on the beach.
I read many other lovely books on the beach, but I wanted to read this with people, and I couldn't possibly shove it into a class. So the Wilson translation is the motive for this.
And by the way, I wanted to be sure to ask this because I was curious this morning, and I ended up looking up the answer. I suspect a lot of our listeners will not know the answer to this question. Why is it called the Iliad? What does the name Iliad refer to?
Well, the AD at the end means kind of story of, right? Mm. And Ilium is another name for Troy. So it's the story of Troy.
Mm. This mythical city and all that happens to it and to its citizens. And yeah, it's an amazing story, one of the great epic poems. And it's, I should think, off the top of my head, it's one of the earliest major texts that is still widely read. I don't imagine there's too much that predates
it. There are other ancient Sumerian. There's other texts that do circulate. I think we often tend to fetishize the Western tradition in certain ways. But
fair enough.
I am not an expert enough to say all of these things, you know, with great certainty. I just know that we really do have certain ways of fetishizing this culture. And I'm doing it too, right, in teaching this text. But I do think it's something that still speaks to us. I actually have a little quote from Wilson that I wanted to, let me see if I can find it now, where she talks about why she did it. So she says, this is on page 59 of the introduction. She says, "We are now in a period of crisis, not for a specific nation, but for humanity, inhabiting a planet that is becoming less and less habitable. A new kind of heartbreak can be felt in the Iliad's representation of a city in its last days, of triumphs and defeats and struggles and speeches that take place in a city that will soon be burned to the ground."
Wow.
In this particular moment.
Yes.
That feels...
Right. We are recording this interview as so wildfires are raging in Hollywood, California. And yeah, that speaks very powerfully to the stresses and fears and changes that are very much a part of our current day.
Yeah.
So Homer's The Iliad is the subject of this community course called Reading the Iliad with four sessions. So tell our listeners when those sessions occur and also what they should do if they want more information and or want to register for this course.
All right. Well, our sessions are going to be February 6th and 20th, March 6th and 20th. They're all Thursdays. Hmm. It's 6 to 7:30 in the library at UW Parkside. If you just make your way into the library, we'll get you to where you need to be. To register, you just need to send an email to iliad@uwp.edu, and that is spelled iliad@uwp.edu, and we'll get you to the registration page from there, and you'll have information about how much you should read and when for each of those sessions. We've got a LibGuide. We've got a lot of sort of resources once you send that email. There is no cost. We invite all people. Typically, we're sort of saying 16 or above. I have a 12-year-old who would probably love to do this. But be ready for adult themes, right? Because there are things here that are definitely explicit in the text and that we'll talk about. So, you know, people need to be prepared. Also, I think you have to be at least 16 to be on campus by yourself.
There you go.
Let's see.
And although this is not a part of that well-known program called Adventures in Lifelong Learning, yes, that I know a lot about, certainly this represents... a great adventure in and of itself, and the experience of exploring a major text like this in this way also promises to be a great adventure in learning that we hope a lot of people will seriously consider. Dana Oswald will be teaching this course. She is department chair and professor of English Literature and Languages at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Professor Oswald, thank you so much for being on the morning show today. It was wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
It is precisely 8:59. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. We are your gateway to Wisconsin Public Radio. We will join Wisconsin Public Radio for the news and then the Wisconsin Today program at 9 o'clock. Let's update the forecast now from the National Weather Service. Not really much change. The forecast today, sunny, windy, and bitterly cold. A high 3 above. Wind chills down to 30 below throughout the day. Tonight, more of the same. Cloudy, windy, continued bitterly cold. A low of minus 2 tonight. Wind chills down to 20 below. And just to put salt in the wound, maybe an inch or two of snow tomorrow. A high of 22 and winds up to 20 miles per hour. Right now, wind west at 10, minus 8 Racine, minus 7 Kenosha.